Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
My students are routinely horrified to discover that 90% of Canadians make less than $65,000 a year. They somehow assume they're going to be in that, you know, 9 or 10% that's going to make a bazillion dollars a year. Then when they start to look at that and when their lives start to reflect it, they start asking questions. Like, what the hell is going on here?
That's the voice of Mark Lear, SFU professor and author. On this week's edition of Latin Waves, we speak to Mark about his new book, Rebel Life: The Life and Times of Robert Gosden, Revolutionary Mystic and Labor Spy. This discussion leads us to an analysis of the contemporary labor movement today in Canada. So stay tuned.
We're very privileged to have Dr. Mark Lear. He is a renowned author and a professor at Simon Fraser University. Very happy to have you on our show.
I'm happy to be here.
Now, you're someone who has followed the labor movement very closely. You've written about it, celebrated many of the victories, and also been very critical of some of the areas where there is room for improvement. One key figure or a key figure of labor history is Gosden. Mm-hmm. And you've written about this in your book titled The Rebel Life. What inspired you to write that book?
Yeah. Well, the first thing that inspired me was that it was an interesting story. I first found out about Robert Gosden, who was active before the First World War and really up until about 1919 in British Columbia and in the United States. First found out about him because he was active in various labor battles here in British Columbia, and he always took a radical line. He was the one who in 1913, when the BC government was arresting striking coal miners on Vancouver Island, addressed a public rally at what's now Empire Stadium, you know, Hastings Park, and said if the premier does not release our jailed miners, he'd better hire someone to taste his coffee in the morning and had better be very careful come hunting season. And the crowd went wild. They loved this speech because this was a particularly repressive period, not just in BC history, but in Canadian and world history. The labor movement was under attack around the world at this time. And so I was drawn to this guy because he was a member of a radical union, the industrial workers of the world, who were anarchists or anarchists, syndicalists in their outlook, and wasn't afraid to talk about sabotage, to talk about general strikes, and to even hint at stronger measures. And he was attacked for that stance by more conservative members in the labor movement. And I thought it was important to tell this story of a labor movement that has always had this battle between its kind of reformist wings and its revolutionary wings, those who advocated direct action, those who said, no, we'll just try to elect a social democratic party or a labor party and hope they'll solve all of our problems.
Well, let's talk about that distinction, because when we look around today, we see a labor movement that it's shrinking, not growing. We see a labor party, for lack of a better word, the NDP seems to be the only labor-oriented party, or at least the media would like to pose it as one, and yet their views are far from radical. So what's missing in this picture?
Well, that radicalism, I sometimes think that the labor movement hasn't had a new idea since 1946, and its new idea then was, let's purge the left. But my point about this book was that's always been going on in the labor movement, and as a result, it's been getting increasingly conservative. There are other reasons as well. One of them is the legislation that at one time enables workers. It gives them the right to organize, but it restricts their ability to act in other ways. And the generations of labor leaders that we've had in the last 20, 30, or 40 years all grew up in a world where unions were legal. And if you followed the rules, you could negotiate contracts. Well, what's happened is that labor has been under attack. The old rules don't apply, but this leadership doesn't have any experience of the bad old days when you got arrested for trying to form a union. You got kidnapped. You might even get murdered for that. I'm not saying we should return to those days. What I am saying is that if you only play by the boss's rules, you're fighting with one hand tied behind your back. So I was interested in an earlier labor movement that had a very radical strand in it, to look at how it evolved and its conflicts with even then a more conservative labor movement that said we need to play it safe, we need to not alienate people who are potential allies. And that's always a concern for any movement. How do you push the edge without alienating potential supporters? So this was in a period where things seemed much more fluid and much more open, and there were different kinds of ideas out there. And Gosden paid a price for lots of his activism. He was essentially blacklisted, couldn't get to work. He was arrested in San Diego for taking part in a free speech fight there, spent about 9 months in jail, spent a few months in jail in Prince Rupert. And then his story gets more interesting, because by 1919, it turns out that this activist, this radical, this extremist, this militant, by 1919 is working as a spy for the RCMP, spying on the labor movement that he had belonged to.
And here, I think, is where the book gets really interesting, because all along you've been captivated by this wonderful person who's fearless, in essence. You can't help but to side with him, right? And suddenly you feel betrayed. You feel that the enemy has been among you the whole time. So let's talk a little bit about that, because we live in a society that wants to create at least a myth, I think, of constancy, of predictability, that we can predict the future. If we do A, B, C, and D, we'll get to Z, and it will be nicely organized. But is this really what labor struggle is like?
No, you're right, Sylvia. It's much more complicated and much less predictable, which is one of the reasons I think that it's so important that the labor movement and movements in general do not simply silence the ones who are characterized as the radicals and extremists. The pragmatists have been running this show for a very long time, and we have seen the working world get worse for people. I'm not speaking here to advocate sabotage. I'm not here to advocate the threatening to assassinate people. What I am saying is that part of that radical message was about direct action. It was about worker militancy. It was about rank and file control of a movement. It does go off in odd places sometimes, no question about that. But to simply refuse to even say the word general strike, for example, to refuse to accept that there are an awful lot of people out there who are extremely angry. And if they do not have ways to channel that energy in constructive ways, it will come out in more destructive ways, which is part of the story about Gosden that I found fascinating, because I don't believe that he was always a traitor. I don't believe he was a spy right from the beginning who's talked a big game. That's important, because there are people in Canada today who take extreme positions. And the first thing you hear from the respectable people out there is, oh, they must be provocateurs working for the police. It is true. Sometimes the police do use provocateurs. But it is also the case that these people have a point that needs to be listened to and taken into consideration when we are sitting down and talking about tactics and strategy. The other point I want to make about Gosden was that part of the reason, I think, by 1919 he is prepared to spy on the labor movement is because of his disillusionment with it, that he sees it as being taken over by the more conservative wing of it. And therefore, this is not his movement anymore. And I don't think he actually had any moral qualms about turning in people that he would not want to call comrades. It's a challenging moral issue, you know. I don't agree with what he did, but his reasons for it are more complicated. And that gets to your point about being unable to predict what people are going to do, what movements are going to do as well.
In the world today, we're living to a depression era, and far worse than the 1930s, which were the years of militancy among the labor movement. And I want to talk about that, but first, perhaps you can talk a little bit about how that picture differs from what we see today from a labor movement, and the level of incredible gap in terms of the wealth distribution and, you know, the kinds of working conditions the workers are being forced to perform under these days. And yet at the same time, this kind of desire to side with the boss, to legitimize the trend to constantly surpass workers' rights over profits. Talk about why is it that in 1930s people were so militant, and people said, well, we're much more comfortable today. And someone who's looking at this at the income gap will say, well, maybe we're not we're not so well, we're not doing so well today.
Yeah. I think the first thing I want to say is that while certainly there were lots of incidents of radicalism, of militancy and fighting back in the 1930s, it's not the case that everybody was on side with this, that what we see is really a militant minority. And much of that militant minority belonged to the Communist Party. There are huge problems with the Communist Parties historically, no question about that. But they did do a couple of things that are not always done as well today. They took that rebel energy and they channeled it into ways in which people could participate and fight back in structured, organized ways. So I think that there were these two things came together. First, that general sense that things are wrong and we must do better. And a party, an organization, call it what you want, that said, we are prepared to fight for this. And we actually have some skills. We've got organizers that have been doing this stuff for 10 years now. We know how to give a great speech. We know how to mobilize people. We've got a printing press. We can get the message out there. And at the same time, when these two things were brought together, that's when you see action happening. It's not enough just for people to feel bad. They need to, because people feel bad right now. No question. They need sparks. They need some sense that they are not alone. And that is something that movements have to build. So while we see lots of things that are exciting, we see the G20 protests and things like that, I'm not sure that we see a same level of organization that has some plan that incorporates the rank and file and builds around that. I'm not arguing for a top-down organization, but it is true that there are people out there with a lot of expertise that we can build this kind of a movement, but it takes a different kind of work.
What will it take in Canada? Because I think part of the problem is also this idea of seeing a movement through a leadership where you need to have someone at the front guiding the masses. Whereas what you're seeing in Egypt and in Tunisia and in other places where uprisals are, it's a ground swelling of people, you know, it's a grassroots movement where it's anarchy, you could say. It is. And yet within that, there seems to be more cohesion and more solidarity among groups because there isn't that top down.
I agree. You're absolutely right. When I talk about the Communist Party, I'm not suggesting that the Vanguard Party is the model to follow here, but using it as an example of what a militant minority that is actively trying to bring in other people to build a movement can do. And I think that that's somewhat different than some of the actions that we've seen in Canada. So when we see the protests around the Olympics here a year or so ago, certainly the media was able to picture that as a group of people who were disconnected from the larger society. Whether that's true or not is another question, but they were not seen by an awful lot of people as representing them at that moment. So I think that what movements have to do is build those kinds of connections, and that's really crucial. But as an organizational model, you're right. What we see happening around the globe now are these much more organic, grassroots kinds of organizations that do bring together the skills that you need to build a movement, because nobody has ever really argued that significant political protest happens spontaneously. That is, in the sense that suddenly people just wake up one morning and just say, that's it, I've had it. They happen voluntarily, mm-hmm. which is a difference between the Vanguard model and the model you're talking about in terms of anarchism. That's not the same as spontaneously, which means, at least in English, that there seems to be no cause to it. Mm-hmm. So nobody has really argued that that is the case. So that's what I'm trying to suggest here. And one of the reasons we don't see that happening in the labor movement in Canada is that we've had for a very long time now, arguably back to Gosden's time before the First World War, a significant part of the labor leadership that is not interested in militancy, is not interested in radicalism, is not interested in rank and file struggle. And they will do just about anything to curtail that rank and fileism, to shut down popular movements. They don't know what to do with them. They don't like them. It throws their agendas awry.
What do you see as some of the barriers then to overcome this administrative role that the leadership has taken rather than this militant role that it should be taking in order to grow and mobilize the movement?
People need to talk to each other. They need to actually sit down and say, what other kinds of paths can we make? How else can we warren our way through this mess here that may take advantage of some of the organizational capacity that the union movement has? I mean, it's got some money, not a lot of money, but some money. It has some tools. And actively work to do these things themselves, to reject the kinds of settlements that are sometimes forced upon them. That takes an awful lot of work, though, and it also requires people who are not just dedicated, but have some kind of cohesion as well. I think you can go into any union local anywhere and find, you know, a couple of people that are angry with the boss, with the government, and with their union. Until they can come together and talk about it, that's all it is. It's people grumbling in a bar. So it is about thinking through that problem. Now, one of the differences from the 1930s, of course, is that people don't live in the communities where they work, by and large. So you might see your co-workers on the job, and afterwards we just all scatter. I mean, SFU is noted for being a commuter campus. There's not even a student life up here in a cohesive kind of a way. There are parts of it, and this radio station is one of them, but you know, look around here on a Friday night at 5 o'clock, and people are your beaten feet off the mountain, right? For the most part.
Pretty much.
Yeah. How do you begin then to combine the workplace grievances with the people that you're living with? It's really difficult. There are lots more distractions today as well, and that's not an accident. You know, the kinds of social media that have been developed can be great organizing tools, but they also mean that there are some people who spend an awful lot of time in their basements wearing their thumbs out rather than talking and meeting with people and thus trying to organize. You know, you can do lots of things online. You can't hold a general strike online.
What are some of the narratives that the academy tells their students that prevents that fertile ground of resistance, of a rebel-like personas to arise from the academy, from the universities?
Of course, one of the things that universities do is tell people not to rebel. We have a huge business faculty here that's all about trying to integrate people into a capitalist system. It trains them how to be bosses. Right? The fact that universities are not universal, that is to say, more people do not go to universities than go to them, and some of the barriers are gender, some of them are race, and a big one is class. And therefore, universities themselves are designed by the people at the top to replicate this society, not to think about challenging it. And today at SFU, for example, they are announcing the gift, a corporate gift of $22 million, that's going to the business school. Right? At the same time, the Faculty of Arts is losing positions, is shrinking. You know, that is the faculty that, in theory, should be teaching people to think critically, to put forward alternative views, is shrinking right here at SFU, right, which used to be the radical campus. Right? There are other problems and issues around this too. That's just the tip of the iceberg. University professors are part of a professional elite. Most of them come from middle class and upper class backgrounds, and they tend to reflect some of that. They're all, you know, they may all be fine people, but their politics are often very different. Also, the professors have become more professional. And by that I mean they spend a lot of time talking to themselves, developing theory, and not so much time working with people and working with people outside the university or outside their disciplines. And I have to say, I'm an example of one of those people. I spend lots of my time locked away in archives, writing books, and doing that kind of work. It's tricky, but it does mean that the role of the university is schizophrenic. That is to say, the people at the top, and you can look at the SFU Board of Governors, and they're just about all from business, right? The people at the top, they have one vision of what the university is supposed to look like, and it's not about creating rebels. But there are professors here that do see their job as being somewhat different, to provoke people, to make them think, to help them transform, not just themselves, but society.
Where do you find hope? Where do you find inspiration to imagine a world that is different than that predetermined world of individualism and everyone for themselves and profits before people?
Well, I find it in a couple of places. And one is with the students that I see who come to me with ideas and with visions and a deep sense that we can and must do better. And so that's really exciting. I see lots of room for hope in places like Egypt, around the world, places in Greece, such as Greece. There are examples all over the place of people who have not given up. I also find some hope in history because things have looked worse than this and have gotten better than this. You know, the 1930s looked pretty dire. The 1940s, we see a lot of people in Canada actually doing somewhat better than they had because they organized, because they fought, and they essentially forced governments to equalize wealth a little. Not enough, and it was certainly gendered and it was racialized then as well. But people made big strides. I find some hope in a labor movement, actually, that in many places is trying to do a better job. That they realize that if they're not growing, then they're shrinking, and they need to find new ways. And I see some very good people in the labor movement who are struggling with the kinds of problems that I've outlined earlier. It's by no means a simple equation that if you are now president of a local or business agent, that you're a reactionary. It's not that simple. There are very good people out there doing work. And I have to say that I also find some hope in studying history, in part because the people I like to read about are people in the 19th and 20th centuries who said we can do better. And there's often a wave of optimism that sometimes seems extremely naive, and yet at the same time has captured something crucial about humanity. When the writings of people like Peter Kropotkin, when he says, look, when the time comes and we actually are changing this world, do not elect a provisional government. Trust the people. They organize their lives every day, right? Under terrible conditions. They thrive and survive in the face of terrible odds. Open up the food supply, and they will do marvelous things with that. Give them the education system. Tap into the creativity of millions of people, and who knows what wonders we'll build. And so I find inspiration there as well as in the people that I see and work with today.
I guess we're almost at the end, but I don't want to go without discussing the issue of class, because most of us, if you're in the university classroom, don't seem to identify as working class. We seem to think we're either middle class, and we don't really know what that middle is, but we know we're in the middle, because being at the bottom would probably be very bad. So what is the relationship within how we see that world and our own ability to connect to struggles that are on our behalf, and sometimes to act against our own interests when we associate our interests with those of politicians or of superstars or people that don't reflect who we are?
Well, it's difficult because, as I've suggested, universities tend to attract and keep people from the middle and upper classes. That was different in the 1960s and 70s and maybe into the 1980s, where it was much more common for kids in working class families to come to university. But their access has been limited over time. You do that by raising the costs, not just of tuition, but even the cost of living. You do it by paying jobs at lower wages than they were before, so people cannot save money and come to university. Some years ago, when Mike Harcourt was premier, he said something like, we're going to raise tuition fees, but students should do what I do, just go out there and get a job in the summer. And they pointed out that 30 years earlier, Mike Harcourt got a job in the summer that paid him $10 an hour. 30 years later, our students are getting jobs in the summer that pay them $10 an hour, right? Mm-hmm. So the reality is that it's much more difficult for people who don't have some money or access to money to get to university. So that's a huge problem, right, in itself. At the same time, the middle class is under an awful lot of attack right now. And so I find students who discover that their future may not be as rosy as they were promised in their high school guidance classes as they're doing their career plannings. My students are routinely horrified to discover that 90% of Canadians make less than $65,000 a year. They somehow assume they're going to be in that 9 or 10% that's going to make a bazillion dollars a year. Then when they start to look at that and when their lives start to reflect it, they start asking questions. Like, what the hell is going on here, right? And then they start being interested. Also, people are, I think, genuinely connected and interested in their species, in what is happening to humanity. And people do care very deeply about what's going on in the world. It's not always clear what they can do about it, but that's why we study and develop movements so people can find ways to plug in to do these things.
I just want to close with one comment. You know, I was doing a story last Saturday on the strike of steel workers in Ontario. 900 workers have been asked to vote to renege on the pension benefits of 9,000 workers. The workers said no, and so they were thrown out and locked out. And what was remarkable about the story is because it was connected to the community of those workers, they lived there, they came out en masse, and they've been giving them food and money to keep the struggle, to keep fighting. What I want to close with is perhaps, what do we need? What's the spark that, you know, I mean, that can get us going? Because I, when we talk about healthcare, it seems we all care about healthcare. But slowly, little pieces of our healthcare are being privatized and being tear apart. Education, we all care about education. You know, you can't find one person that says, oh, we don't need education. Whether we see it as something that happens organically and on the streets or something that happens in the classroom, we care about, you know, growing, learning from each other's experience. So what's the stop? Where are the barriers that we need to overcome?
Oh, Sylvia, I wish I knew what the spark was, and I wish I had a simple key for this, you know, and I'm afraid I don't, except to say that people learn from struggle. And they learn lessons, I think you can't learn that from books. You can learn some things from books. You can lots of things from books. You can, even if you're lucky, learn something from one of my books. But the real lessons are going to take place when people actually get engaged and they start to learn this. And there are tons of resources out there, and they're going to be from your neighbors. They're going to be from people you work with who have experience, who know how to organize something. It may not be a union. It might be a church dinner, but the principles are the same. Right? And people are going to take those skills that we all exercise, and every day we do. We have, you know, this huge amount of knowledge and abilities to do these things, to simply just do our lives, and to take those and then say, okay, now we need to do two things. We need to shift the blame pattern up, so we don't blame each other and we don't blame people around us, but we blame the people who are in charge. We shift the blame pattern and we fight to make sure that we get the changes that we want.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
My guest is Dr. Mark Lear. He is the professor at Simon Fraser University, the author of many books. The book we're talking about is Rebel Life, which is now under review. When will it come out?
They're telling me May, but I have to do some revisions yet, because I found out lots more stuff about Robert Gosden in the last year since the book first came out.
A fascinating character, a wonderful human being, and you know, something for us to learn from, right? What happens when we create areas of despair where people don't feel invited and welcome, and, you know, where ideas are rejected. Yes. Thank you again for being with
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cambia lo superficial.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.